Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Monday, April 27th, 2015, and the Eagles open our podcast today from Desperado. The song is called Out of Control. And I believe the FBI has spun out of control. That's the headline at Who, What, Why today, and our friend and colleague Russ Baker wrote the headline, Out of Control FBI to Former Head of 9/11 Investigation, Butt Out. And you may have heard that recently I interviewed former Florida Senator Bob Graham. He chaired the Intelligence Committee on 9/11 and also ran the first official investigation into the events of September 11th, 2001. And while I politely criticized Senator Graham for being himself too polite and too diplomatic, as he described the active efforts of the FBI to obstruct his efforts to get the public to see the full unredacted 28-page memo about the Saudi financing for the alleged hijackers of September 11th. Well, Russ Baker goes a little deeper and got an anecdote out of Bob Graham that I didn't get, and I give Baker credit for this. He writes, a top FBI official brazenly warned off the former chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence because of his persistence in pursuing connections between the Saudi royal family and the 9/11 attacks. And this story's almost 4 years old. It occurred in 2011 when Bob Graham was traveling to visit a family member in the Washington area, flew into Dulles Airport, where he was apparently without any advance notice grabbed by a top official of the FBI, who took him to an FBI office that is located at the airport and tried to get Bob Graham to sit down, shut up, and stop asking questions about the Saudi memo. Graham tells it this way. We got off the plane, a couple of FBI people met us, said they'd like us to attend a meeting, so we went. The FBI has an office at Dulles, and there were two FBI people and an attorney from the Department of Justice. And basically, we spent an hour with them trying to convince me to forget this, that it was a dead end, that all that was needed to be learned about it had already been learned. The phrase, get a life, was sort of my summary of that conversation. So consider what this means. An insider who is briefed on all of the secrets of our government is trying desperately, in his own way, to hold the government accountable and to give us, the American people, the information he thinks we deserve to know. And the FBI is brushing him back. And what are they doing? They're trying to keep the cover-up in place. We know there's a cover-up. It's as obvious as the bald head on the top of my the top of my body. Now, Graham went on to say that in this conversation, that he pointed out that their public statement was inconsistent with their own classified files. Now, that's a polite way of saying that the FBI was publicly lying or misleading the American the American population. So the FBI officer got into doublespeak, said, well, that was a matter of context, and there was other information which refuted the statements which were contained in the investigative officer's report. And not buying that line of bullshit, Bob Graham said, well, can I see what other information that you have? And the guy said, yes. And we set a date for a week later. And when I went to the FBI office at the scheduled time, that same agent who was at the meeting at Dulles was there, and he said, your meeting here has been canceled, is not going to be rescheduled, and incidentally, I know you've been trying to contact the agent who wrote the report, and I have told him not to talk with you. So this is very clear. The FBI sees part of its job as keeping the buttons on the buttoned-up cover-up from 9/11. And Russ notes here in the Who, What, Why article that both Bush and Obama have signed executive orders keeping the pages of Graham's report dealing with the Saudis classified. And we know that the president, in a private meeting with one of the Jersey Girl widows of 9/11, Kristen Breitweiser, and Senator Graham recently reconfirmed this for me, that President Obama told her that he would see that that memo is released. Double talk? Outright lies? I'll let you decide, but the bottom line for me is that the FBI is out of control. It is beyond the executive branch control. We saw that when the FBI director, Bob Mueller, wanted to stay a couple of years, nobody put up any protest, despite the whole idea that the FBI director is supposed to serve only a single 10-year term to avoid the abuses that occurred under J. Edgar Hoover. And the inaction of all of our top elected officials, the failure of Congress to fulfill its oversight role over the FBI, it suggests to me that we're back in the Hoover zone, where the FBI has dirt on enough elected officials that they can do what they want without any accountability. Now, here's just the latest story, published by the Daily Mail today. In April, that's this month, an FBI agent's sniper rifle was ripped out of his car and stolen from a Salt Lake City hotel parking lot just days before President Obama visited Salt Lake City. Now, the gun was secured in a safe in the back seat of a car. It was in a hard rifle case. It was padlocked and chained. But the thief apparently broke the passenger side window in the rear on the right side, tied a rope around the rifle case's handle, and using a vehicle, apparently used that to just pull it apart. Now, most of the stuff in the kit that was stolen was left behind or somehow returned, but not the sniper rifle. And the real painful part of this, it was in a parking lot without video cameras, no surveillance, located right down the street from the FBI headquarters in Salt Lake City. Today I've released a fascinating interview, if I do say so myself, a conversation with Shahid Buttar. He is a lawyer and the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and a man I deeply respect. We go into some detail on the dismal legacy of Eric Holder, the Attorney General. Today his successor, Loretta Lynch, is being sworn in. And we talk about our very low expectations for Attorney General Lynch. She's in the lame duck, era of the Obama administration. She doesn't have, as far as we know, a network of people in Washington that she can rely on. And so we offer advice. Shahid Buttar joins me in calling for the outright abolition of the Drug Enforcement Agency, which is an offshoot of the Justice Department. And we call on the new Attorney General to rein in the FBI. And we note the recent disclosure of the total failure of its hair analysis program that produced thousands of false convictions, including some who were executed based on false testimony supplied by FBI agents. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Shahid Buttar.
There's a new documentary that's out and just played actually at the Tribeca Film Festival in late April, and I think in March at Sundance.
It's called Terror, and the T is in parentheses.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You've got it. And I just spoke at the screening at Tribeca. There's a very brief moment toward the end of the film where the filmmakers include some footage from a press conference at which I spoke in Washington, and the depiction of both what I would just describe very simply as the corruption pervading the FBI's counterterrorism operations. You know, what you see in this film is a very stark relief view of one of these sting operations, and you see how totally contrived they are. Yeah. And these are the cases on which the Bureau has built its the case for its ever-increasing budgets over the last 15 years. And you look at the actual facts of one of these cases, and it would be a joke if it weren't so horrifying.
Well, and
this
just
goes on every day.
Just in the past week, we've had confirmation that the technology that the FBI embraced, using hair samples to identify suspects and convict people, is so riddled
thousands of cases.
Yes, thousands of cases, including nine men who were executed, Shahid, based on evidence and testimony that has now been declared highly suspect, if not flatly false. And there's no outrage in our country about this.
That's exactly right.
I am stunned.
Well, I think there is outrage. What I think there hasn't been is any corresponding policy or oversight solutions, right? I mean, I think people are absolutely outraged that our nation's, you know, chief prosecutors have been contriving evidence against people for decades. I think people are outraged that our nation's prosecutors are going easy on big institutions. I think where the, again, where it gets really challenging, what do you do about it? Because, you know, one of the big problems here structurally is simply the role of prosecutors in our criminal justice system, right? When prosecutors can intimidate most people from ever even attempting to exercise their rights, by overcharging them and threatening them essentially with catastrophic penalties should they take their cases to trial and lose, but that's a problem. And that's something, quite frankly, that the Justice Department can rein in because they are the nation's chief prosecutors. And if there was a mandate and a policy to not use charging decisions as a means of coercing people and trying to keep them away from taking their legitimate defenses to trial, that would make a world of difference, but you won't hear an attorney general talk about that.
I hope you'll listen to the full conversation with Shahid Buttar. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. And I always like to thank the people who support my work here. Every month, the first of the month, the check arrives from Paul L. Sesser, a longtime supporter of ours, Julie Dupree, and Created by Gale. They're both very generous contributors. And Carol Krez just renewed her annual subscription. Thank you, each and every one of you. And I want to invite others to join the chorus. I need more supporters to keep this all going. So come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the link under my picture. It takes you to the page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. Or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers earn a bonus gift from me. It's the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest called Empire of Chaos. And Mr. Escobar is scheduled to do an interview with us in the next few days, so you should be hearing his thoughts on the world situation very soon. Well, last week we know President Obama revealed that in January, mid-January, a drone strike, he says, accidentally killed an American prisoner and an Italian prisoner being held by the Taliban in the border area between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And as you know, I'm deeply critical of the claims by the administration that the use of drones produces very few civilian casualties or unintended victims. And I believe that net-net this program is counterproductive. And as I've said before, I don't think that drones should never be used. But we are using them in ways and at a level, a frequency level, based on flimsy information from the ground, that in my view produces more blowback than it does whatever we think our successful missions do. And so the New York Times went into full echo chamber spin mode on Sunday with a front page story headlined Deep Support in Washington for CIA's Drone Missions. And that's true. There is far too little criticism of the drone programs. In fact, I would submit that they've never been fully debated and that the Congress has never exercised its important role in placing limits or protocols on how drones are used, how targets are selected. Congress is content to let the president grab that power and assert it to himself in a very dangerous expansion of executive authority, I believe. And the Times itself talks about how the macabre ritual of weekly visits to CIA headquarters by, I'm sorry, monthly visits by those with security clearances who work for the senators and members of the House Intelligence Committee. And they go over to CIA and they watch videos of people being killed by drone strikes. And they're given background information on the intelligence that led to it, but they're not allowed to see the internal CIA cables that discuss the attacks and their aftermaths. And Mark Mazzetti and Matt Apuzzo, who wrote this article for the Times, correctly described the veneer of congressional oversight It is simply a veneer. And they make the case, although lawmakers insist that there's great accountability to the program, interviews with administration and congressional officials show that Congress holds the program to less careful scrutiny than many members assert. And one of those is my senior senator, Dianne Feinstein, who, for example, quote, the figures we have obtained from the executive branch, which we have done our utmost to verify, confirm that the number of civilian casualties that have resulted from such strikes each year has typically been in the single digits. She said that in 2013. And I don't believe a word of it. Because we know that the use of these signature strikes are not based on accurate intelligence about exactly who is in a specific place before we attack it. And the president's admissions regarding the prisoners and the two Americans who declared themselves members of Al-Qaeda who were summarily executed, he says by mistake, which then bypasses any analysis of whether an intentional assassination of those two Americans would have violated American law. And so I see two critical issues here. The arrogation of power by the executive. And Obama is doing it to a much greater extent than even Bush did. And that with weak intelligence, we end up killing innocent people and creating the next wave of enemies for the United States. Now, in this article, it's noteworthy that the New York Times revealed the identities of three top CIA officers against the advice of the CIA. They've named one of them before, Michael D'Andrea, who got demoted recently. He was in charge of the drone program as head of the Counterterrorism Center at the CIA. The article also names the new people in charge. D'Andrea was replaced by Chris Wood. Wood held leadership roles at Alex Station, that's the group that led the hunt for Al-Qaeda suspects, and Michael Scheuer, who many people are aware of, once ran the Alec desk. He is now reporting directly to John Brennan, who was previously the drone meister at the White House. The other person identified is Greg Vogel, a former agency paramilitary officer who has now taken over the Directorate of Operations. And he was a top dog in the drone efforts. And he goes way back to the George Tenet era. He was one of the people who is credited of saving the life of Hamid Karzai, and his reward was that he ran the CIA station in Kabul for many years. So it's interesting that the Times is willing to edge out there and report the names of these individuals. But the spin continues as other stories in the Times try to talk about how effective the drone program has been in decimating Al-Qaeda. But we've been hearing this from Bush and now Obama, you know, that we've just decimated Al-Qaeda. But then we're told that we have to cough up our metadata and submit to searches at the airport and act like a hunted quarry because of Al-Qaeda. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't withstand scrutiny and careful rational thought. And that's what I discussed in some detail with psychiatrist Justin Frank in the in-depth interview that we released just a couple of days ago here at peterbcollins.com. So on Friday, the president went to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, you know, the chief perjurer, James Clapper, and he talked to the team over there about drone strikes. These aren't abstractions. We're not cavalier about what we do. We understand the solemn responsibilities that are given to us, he told the professionals. And our first job is to make sure we protect the American people. Well, not really, Mr. President. Your first job is to protect and defend the Constitution. You took an oath for that. You've never taken an oath to defend or protect the American people. No one does. And so we have this very public show of the president's emotion. But underscoring all this is that 2 years ago he gave a speech where he said he's going to move the drone program out of the CIA and over to the Pentagon exclusively. And he got skunked. It didn't happen. He gave a speech. He told us he was going to order that. And 2 years later, the status quo remains. And this leads to questions that are very obvious. Who is controlling these decisions? Because they don't appear to be consistent with the views and the aspirations of the President of the United States. A couple of troubling reports were published broadcast on Sunday. In my local paper, the San Francisco Chronicle, I was surprised at an excellent story written by a reporter I've never heard of named Brooks Mencher. The story is entitled Future War, and it defines lethal autonomous weapons, or LAWs. And this is a cross between a drone, a robot, and it's fueled by artificial intelligence. And they report on a conference that was held in the third week of April in Geneva in an attempt to define the level of artificial intelligence needed for an international definition of robotic autonomy. Now, that may sound way in the weeds and really wonky, but we're on the verge of being capable of having a war that was started by one of our robots against one of their robots, and it could be fought and it would be over, and civilians and others would have been killed before a human would have been consulted about whether we really want to go ahead with this or not. And the article quotes a UC Berkeley professor, Stuart Russell, who says, against such systems, humans will be largely defenseless. Now, when I look at this, some of it is science fiction. It's kind of futuristic. And I say, well, okay, you know, we got to cover all our bases, right? But as we develop the unmanned aerial drones that I've been talking about, presumably at Area 51 in Nevada, there was no debate. There's no international treaty related to the use of drones, legitimately in war or not. And so, with the advances in artificial intelligence and unpiloted aircraft and robotics, we could end up with a war that is basically conducted on an Xbox system. Now, if we could actually get to that and turn war into a virtual experience, where the opponents accept the outcome of the Xbox game? Well, that would be progress. But when you look at the list, the United States has the X-47B flying wing built by Northrop Grumman being tested as part of a proposed fleet of drones. And by the way, that high-tech device is deployed on the aircraft carrier Theodore Roosevelt, which we just redeployed to the coast of Yemen. We also have long-range anti-ship missiles that use autonomous guidance algorithms for precision strikes, Crusher, a 14,000-pound off-road unmanned ground combat vehicle. The Russians, the Israelis, the French, the Chinese all have similar toys. The second broadcast, the second report that was broadcast on CBS 60 Minutes was essentially a huge propaganda piece for the U.S. Space Command. It was also essentially a major intentional leak by a super secret agency. They trotted out the general who runs the program, and they gave us partial information, some of which is fascinating. Before I get to that, though, I want to note that as I watched this, I was thinking to myself, CBS 60 Minutes got this juicy package hand-delivered to it by the federal government. It's probably going to spike their ratings for last night. And how did they get that? Why were they chosen? And in my own little mind, and I'm not telling you that this is conclusive or persuasive beyond that, but I link it to the way they shortchanged various whistleblowers, from Sybil Edmonds to the NSA whistleblowers, to Ed Snowden, to Chelsea Manning, where they partially cover these stories, but the omissions are glaring. And why would CBS do that? Well, to maintain access, to keep friendly eyes and ears inside the government who are willing to say, yeah, 60 Minutes deserves that. They'll play ball. They'll only use their crayons inside the lines that we give them. So, despite that, the takeaways from it are that China has developed some very significant capabilities. And a couple of years ago, they shot down one of their own satellites from orbit around the Earth. It was a clean hit, a direct kill. It's created a bunch of space debris that's really problematic. But it shows they've made significant advances. And in more recent years, I think it was 2013, China successfully launched a missile, a rocket, into deep space. Up there where all of our high-tech weapons and surveillance systems are based. And I don't yet have a clear answer to this, but I'll pose the question. Why is our government trying to tell us about potential space wars with China? Over the weekend, they held the Adelson primary, where the billionaire casino mogul and Zionist extremist Sheldon Adelson invited the Republican presidential candidates to come and kiss his ass. And most of them did. It's called the Republican-Jewish Coalition. And they even got George W. Bush to show up. I wonder what his speaking fee was. But W., who's been busy, you know, with his watercolors and other pursuits, seems a little confused about what he did as president, particularly in relation to Iraq, because he pretty well knows that he's responsible for the blunder of our invasion and the fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction. But now that his brother is running for president, he recognizes what a liability his presidency represents to Jeb. But he tries to rewrite history in an effort to slam Barack Obama. At one point, according to sources who attended this meeting, W. cited Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who has criticized Obama's policies in the Middle East. And Bush quoted Graham saying, pulling out of Iraq was a strategic blunder. But the plan to leave Iraq was Bush's plan. And Obama simply executed it. And in telling this lie, Bush has to ignore another truth, and that is that Leon Panetta and Barack Obama were feverishly trying to change the terms of the agreement that had been negotiated by Bush and get the Maliki government in Iraq to let large numbers of American troops stay there beyond the exit date that had been set by Bush. Maddening. Our friend Joe Lauria, the independent journalist who covers the UN, has a great story in the Wall Street Journal today. And he reports that Yemen's warring factions were on the verge of a power-sharing deal about a month ago when Saudi Arabia abruptly started its airstrikes on the country. And Joe Lauria interviewed Jamal Ben-Omar, who for the UN had spearheaded the negotiations until he resigned a week ago. And he told Lauria, the Saudi bombing campaign against Iran-linked Houthi rebels has hardened positions on a key point: the composition of an executive body to lead Yemen's stalled transition. When this campaign started, Ben-Omar said, one thing that was significant but went unnoticed is that the Yemenis were close to a deal that would institute power sharing with all sides, including the Houthis. The UN talks had begun in January, included 12 different factions, and the Houthis had agreed to remove their militias from the cities they were occupying under the deal. And they were going to even allow Hadi, the Western-backed president who's now in Riyadh, to be part of an executive body that would run the country temporarily. But after the Saudis started dropping bombs on Yemen, the Houthis changed their terms, and the Saudi-backed factions there have also hardened their positions, trying to exclude the Houthis from power altogether. So it's a complicated picture. I've asked Joe Lauria to be our guest on the Processing Distortion interview podcast this week. And if that works out, I'll tip you off and bring you an excerpt from it later in the week. In Baltimore today, my fingers are crossed for a peaceful funeral for Freddie Gray. Thousands are expected to attend. And it's been an unrestful weekend in Baltimore, although it didn't go into full Ferguson, I'll say. But the cops are clearly on edge. They revealed that a number of gangs in Baltimore, including the Crips, the Bloods, and the Black Gorilla Family, have put down their rivalries and entered a partnership to take out law enforcement officers. Now, that's a scary prospect. And we have to question whether it's accurate. Because it would take a hell of a lot to get Crips, Bloods, and their rivals to join together for a common cause, even when it's, quote-unquote, making pigs fly. So I am skeptical of that, but report it to you for your own consideration. The cops did rough up a couple of reporters over the weekend. An independent outlet called the City Paper posted video showing that reporter J.M. Giordano was being beaten at the hands of police as he tried to cover the protests. And finally today, I've talked about the recalcitrance of California Governor Jerry Brown to announce a moratorium on fracking, especially considering our drought and the huge amounts of water that are wasted in injection well processes and fracking. And Tom Hayden, a man I deeply respect, who, of course, was a Weather Underground member, or maybe it was the SDS back in the Vietnam era. He was once married to Jane Fonda. He served with considerable distinction in the California legislature as both an assembly member and a state senator. He ran for governor. And he published an op-ed in the San Francisco Chronicle this weekend, encouraging Governor Brown to put to sleep a state agency which is called Dogger. And forgive the dog reference. Chloe's a little offended just to hear me say that right here. But the interesting thing that Hayden points out is that Jerry Brown is kind of trapped because of some things that happened during his first tour of duty as governor of California in the 70s and 80s. He signed a law, an agreement in 1982, that essentially established self-regulation for big oil in California. If you want to drill a well, you don't need a permit. You just send a letter to this Dogger agency, the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, and if they don't tell you within 10 days that you can't drill there, you just go right ahead. That is the state of lax regulation in California. And so the Federal Environmental Protection Agency is pushing Brown to move regulation from Dogger to the Cal EPA. And that's what Tom Hayden is writing about, and at least on the face of it, it seems like a pretty damn good idea to me. Hey, thanks for joining me today and listening all the way to the end of my ranting and raving here on the News and Comment podcast. I hope you'll share it with a friend or someone.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.